Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and welcome to our book pick segment. We are thrilled each and every week when we get to be joined by two incredible representatives from an independent bookstores in our region. We are very, very lucky to have this incredible family. And they come and they tell us about great books that are in their stores. And we get to hear about all kinds of cool stuff. Today, we welcome Amy Zimmerman from Chatham Bookstore in Chatham, New York. Hello, Amy. How are you?
I'm great. Happy to be here inside in the AC.
Yeah, it's nice. It feels good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's good. Matt Tenenbaum from the bookstore in Lenox, Massachusetts. Good morning, Matt. How are you?
Hello, Joe. Good to see you. I'm fine, thank you. You look terrific.
Thank you very much. Radiant?
Radiant, yes.
Yes, that's right.
Glistening.
Well, thank you. that's just the sweat. But it's really nice to have you both here. Amy, where would you like to begin?
Sure. I can start off. So my first pick is Carrie Carolyn Coco, a new work of nonfiction from Sarah Gerard. This is a book that defies categorization, teetering at the edges of true crime, memoir, biography, and journalistic expose. This book contains many books, which makes it both remarkable and at times challenging to read, a never-ending nesting doll with a horrific crime at its core, the 2016 murder of the author's friend, Carolyn Bush, a 25-year-old writer. A former Bard student, Bush was stabbed to death by her roommate, a Bard alum. Oof. I know. Mm. I picked up this book totally unaware of the Bard connection. I was just a fan of the writer. And as I read, I was surprised to find that it is a significant part of the book. One of Gerard's projects here seems to be placing Caroline's murder within a lineage of violence, particularly gender-based violence, at Bard, and making a compelling case for the university's complicity. It wasn't clear to me how many of these cases and allegations were already widely known and what was original reporting, but it was all pretty shocking to me, and it's a big part of why I wanted to bring this book here to Book Picks, because of its local relevance and specificity. Reading true crime can often feel personally threatening or destabilizing, like the dark events being described are coming closer and closer, and that sensation was really heightened here with a book that cites neighbors and local luminaries, restaurants and coffee shops in Rhinebeck, and even a bar in the town where I live, where Caroline apparently stayed for a few weeks shortly before her death. In addition to the Bard thread, Gerard attempts a detailed biography of Caroline, from childhood into her mid-20s, as well as a mirrored, if less comprehensive, portrait of her killer. There's a minute-by-minute accounting of the crime, detailed reporting from court appearances, and an investigation into the social dynamics and creative output of Caroline's social circle. Of all of these lines of inquiry, it's the portrait of Caroline that's most artful and compelling, and Gerard's real contribution, in my opinion, to the genre of true crime. More than the killer or even the crime itself, Gerard has centered Caroline here. Not just the details of her final hours or the cliches used to describe her in the press, but all the messiness and glory of a life interrupted.
The name of the book is Carrie Carolyn Coco, and it's by Sarah Gerard. Fascinating. All right,
I have a crime book, but it's fiction. It's called Chasing Rembrandt, and it's about a detective, a gay detective named Don Strachey from Albany, right here in Albany, New York, whose husband Timothy Callahan was in the Peace Corps, and he gets a call one day from an old Peace Corps friend in Lenox, who says she's got the deathbed confession of her aunt, who, it turns out, was hiding the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum paintings.
Oh, wow.
But then they got stolen again. So Don has to find out who stole them the second time. You find out who stole them the first time, easy. That's in the first couple of pages. I can't tell you. And then... And then it's a great, fun mystery book. It makes fun, but not makes fun. It takes pot shots at the FBI, at the Boston Police, at the Lenox Police, at the art scene in Newbury Street in Boston. It's a great book, and you'll find out all about the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum and what happened that night back in 1990. So it's called Chasing Rembrandt. and just got published. And Richard Stevenson, the author, died a couple of years ago. He told me about this book, and I thought he hadn't finished it, but apparently he had. And it just got published a couple of months ago. So we just got it in, Chasing Rembrandt.
Excellent. Great choice. All right, next up.
So all of my picks coming up are all beach reads. So we think the beach read generally does not get a lot of respect. The term conjures up interchangeable waterlogged paperbacks with white sand beaches and big sun hats on the covers, guilty pleasure, empty calorie reading. So every summer at the bookstore, we're always on the lookout for beach reads that defy these low expectations. Fun, sun-drenched page turners that are a lot smarter than they need to be. So our bookstore owner, Sharon, who couldn't be here today, has passed along a few of her picks for this elevated beach read category. The first one is How to Read a Book by Monica Wood, about three very different people whose lives intersect in surprising and ultimately inspiring ways. It is narrated by Violet, a 22-year-old who has been serving a manslaughter sentence in a Maine prison. She joins a book club in prison that is led by Harriet, a retired former teacher. Harriet is admired from afar by Frank, whose wife was actually the victim in the car crash caused by Violet. It's a setup filled with tension, but also love and empathy. We watch the connection slowly build among these three, who come to form a warm and caring family. There's also a fascinating subplot, according to Sharon, about extremely intelligent parrots. Take her word for it. This is a book that makes you feel sad and also hopeful. It's about how we can truly look beyond the obvious to find the beautiful.
And again, the author is?
Monica Wood.
Monica Wood, How to Read a Book. Because we need to know how to do that.
First of all, open it.
Yes, and then just devour.
Yeah, just put a napkin on.
Next up from you, sir.
This is Music in Mind, Renee Fleming's book. Do you know? Have you had?
Oh, we've had Renee Fleming on our program many times.
Yeah, she was just in Tanglewood. Did you see her last week?
I did not. No.
Yeah. She can carry a tune, huh?
she's very talented.
She's very talented. And she's on the board of the NIH, and she's done all this work. And she's written this book, or she's edited this book called Music in Mind, Harnessing the Arts for Health and Wellness. And she has essays, maybe 30, 40 essays by writers, by doctors, by therapists, by actors. My favorite are the novelists. Richard Powers has an essay on birds singing. He says, you know, if you ask an ornithologist, why do birds sing? They'll give you all this explanation about mating and seasons and such. If you ask a bird why they sing, they like to. That's what they do. And it's what makes you feel good. And so these other neuroscientists talk about how the auditory experience of music, how it gets translated into the brain. So you have all these wonderful essays. Did you talk about this book when she was on?
I did not, no.
Okay. So this is Music in Mind, published by Viking Press. And it's
massive.
It's a beach read. It's very light. The paper is
yes, yeah.
You know, it's 400 and something, almost 500 pages, but it feels very light. Here, hold it. You can read this.
Get a lot of sunscreen if you're going to read this thing. You're right, though. It is lighter. Yeah. Well, that's good.
Well, you know, publishers do that. They'll have a book. You know, if they want to make it an academic book, they'll coat the paper. And it'll be a heavier stock, and the book will be heavier.
I'm skeptical. Yeah,
no,
this massive hardcover.
No, it's pretty light.
Okay, it could be heavier.
Yeah, I mean, Covenant of Water or Bee Sting. I think it's a much lighter book.
Right. Yeah.
Now we're really getting in the weeds, but that's okay.
To read a book.
The name of the book is. Name of the book is Music in Mind by Renee Fleming. The editor of that, and terrific stuff. All right, more beach reading.
Yes. So next up, I'm nominating another great summer read, The Pairing by Casey McQuiston, which comes out on August 6th. If you've read McQuiston before, you already know that she writes queer romance novels that serve up deft characterization, humor, and some really well-written prose alongside all of the classic genre tropes. And this new book is no exception. There's a ridiculous premise, of course. Two exes who haven't spoken since their breakup find themselves on the same food and wine tour of Europe. We've all been there, right? Naturally, because they are both young, chaotic bisexuals, they decide to deal with their romantic tension by challenging each other to a hookup competition as they tear across the continent. There's nothing I hate more than a totally unrealistic, sanitized romance where two Barbie and Ken-type characters fall into a perfect monogamous relationship. This book is nothing like that, with two complicated and deeply human characters who are both defined by their massive appetites for life and love and food and wine and art. I love that this book is sensual and that the unbridled hedonism isn't contained to the sex scenes. The food descriptions are just as, if not more, pornographic than the sex. This is a book about appreciating beautiful things, whether that's wine in Chianti, a Caravaggio in Rome, or your ex. It's messy and decadent and surprisingly touching, a book that will make you want to fall in love and eat a four-course meal, which is more than you can expect from your average beach read.
Absolutely. The Pairing is the name of the book by Casey McQuiston.
Yeah, you got there.
Casey McQuiston. I've heard that.
She wrote Red, White, and Royal Blue.
Oh, which they turned into that movie. Yes, all right. Well, good stuff. Okay. All right.
Good stuff.
Next up, Matt.
Do you know who wrote a book similar to that? That story?
Tell me.
Edith Wharton.
Okay. Very similar books, I'm sure.
Glimpses of the Moon.
Yep.
Was about a couple who are helping each other across Europe find love and romance.
I love this. Highbrow, lowbrow.
Highbrow, lowbrow. That's...
By the way, Matt is riffing now, so you will not find this particular title on the book list on the website, but that's all right. It's a bonus.
There's your bonus point, right. Okay, but speaking of Europe, my next book is a sweet, lovely book called Mozart in Italy, Coming of Age in the Land of Opera. This is a musical summer for me, the Renee Fleming book and now Jane Glover's book, Mozart in Opera. When Leopold Mozart decided his son was going to be the superstar that he was going to be, he took him to Italy. And he brought him to all the towns in Italy, and he had great letters of introduction from Salzburg to, let's say, Bologna or Milan. But the first, I forget the first stop he made. And then he had letter. Then, as Mozart, as an 8-year-old, would perform, he would to the aristocrats. He would get more letters of introduction. By the time he reached Rome, he had an audience with the Pope. You know. Then he went to Naples, and he got a commission to write an opera in Milan when he was 15. So I didn't know all this about Mozart. I knew that Mozart, you know, I've been to Mozart operas. I like Mozart operas. Now I'm learning how he, at the age of 15, how he wrote his first opera. He didn't even have the libretto. He started writing the music. He didn't have the libretto. He didn't know the singers until just a month before the opera was performed. He would write songs, he would write these arias, and then he would listen to them sing and then adjust it like a coach adjusting your batting stance, you know, in the big game.
Right.
Just incredible. And Jane Glover has it's almost a diary of their trip through Italy, the muddy roads, the bad accommodations and how they persevered through it all.
Jane Glover is the author. Mozart in Italy is the name of the book. Next up.
So now I have another Sharon pick, To and Fro by Leah Hager Cohen. This is actually two books in one, featuring the same young girl growing up in Manhattan in one book or in a mythical land in the other. You can actually start with either story, To or Fro, and then turn it over to read the second story. They intersect in the middle, literally. The text in the middle tracks both of the stories. It's a complicated conceit, but the stories are somehow both magical and deeply grounded. The Manhattan-based realistic story is a poignant telling of the challenges of being a girl today, navigating confusing and sometimes conflicting messages. This character is also drawn to Jewish teaching and mysticism, which links the two stories in interesting ways. Like How to Read a Book, this is a book that explores identity and community and how they can develop in surprising and wonderful ways.
To and Fro by Leah Hager Cohen. Matt.
So here's that Mozart in Italy. I wanted to.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It's a beautiful book.
What a beautiful book by Picador.
Picador. It's now that has a little heavier stock.
Even seems very heavier.
It's a smaller book, yep. but it's heavier than. It's
well, and there's color
photographs,
pictures,
right.
And yeah, okay,
right.
All right, very beautiful, gorgeous book.
Lovely book.
Okay,
but my next one is an older book. I don't know if you ever had Brooke Allen on your show.
Yes.
Okay, so she wrote this book, Moral Minority, which came out what in 2006 or 2008
correct.
Or so.
Yes.
But we've been selling the. What would you say? The bejesus out of this book.
Yes.
And it's about, but it's not about Jesus.
Our Skeptical Founding Fathers.
By Brooke Allen. And I opened it up at random when I first started reading it, and I opened up to the chapter on Hamilton. In the chapter on, so it's about Hamilton, Washington, Jefferson, Hamilton, Franklin, Adams. Who am I missing?
I'm looking at the pictures of the people in the book.
Those guys.
Yeah.
And how they were not Christians. They were skeptics. The
Franklin, Washington, John Adams, Jefferson, Madison, and Hamilton.
So the United States says, the quote from in the Hamilton chapter was from Seneca, in which he says, it's a great line. We should all listen to this. Religion is regarded by the common people as true, by the wise as false, and by the rulers as useful. Does that resonate with us these days? So the United States was not founded on Christian principles, but on Enlightenment ideas, not based on Jesus Christ, but on John Locke. God entered the picture only as a very minor player. Then she has stories about Jefferson taking a razor to his Bible and cutting out every miraculous or supernatural occurrence. Washington rewriting speeches others had crafted for him so as to omit references to Jesus. Franklin and Adams confining their doubts about Christ's divinity. Madison expressing deep disapproval over the appointment of a chaplain to Congress. Even George Will liked this book.
Even George Will.
George Washington would not kneel to pray, and when his pastor rebuked him for setting a bad example by leaving services before communion, Washington mended his ways. In his austere manner, he stayed away from church on communion Sundays. In 1953, the year before Under God was added to the Pledge of Allegiance, President Eisenhower declared July 4th a day of penance and prayer. That day, he went fishing in the morning, golf in the afternoon, and played bridge in the evening.
Well, that's fascinating that it's coming back, that it has found new life. That's great.
Yeah, we've been selling lots of copies of this book all the last couple of years.
I know Brooke from her husband, Peter Aaron, who's a wonderful photographer.
Okay.
Brooke taught over at, am I right on this? I could be wrong on this.
Okay.
Somewhere. At Bennington College.
Okay.
I think so.
And they live here in Albany, right? Or
sure.
Nearby,
yeah.
Somewhere.
Yeah. That's right, somewhere.
Okay.
Next.
Me? Amy. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So this is my last pick, and I know that this novel was recommended last week, sorry, but I couldn't talk about books of the summer without at least mentioning The Wedding People by Alison Especk, which comes out at the end of the month, very soon. So this is another book with sort of a bold premise. The protagonist, Phoebe Stone, still reeling over her husband's affair, checks into a very fancy hotel in Newport with the intention of ending her life. However, Phoebe's plans are quickly upended by the presence of a large wedding party at the hotel, so large, in fact, that Phoebe is the only non-wedding guest. Despite her best efforts, she is quickly subsumed by the festivities, becoming a confidant to the bride, nursing a crush on the groom, and generally becoming the receptacle for everyone's wedding-related secrets, hopes, and anxieties. It might sound like a strange cocktail of frivolity and despair, but the characterization and the writing is so well done that you totally buy it. Phoebe is the heart of this book. She is relatable and funny, even at her lowest, and it's a joy to watch her come back into herself and defy her own expectations. I would recommend this book to fans of All Fours, the amazing new novel from Miranda July, that we are also selling bucket loads of.
Both. That's a great book, too.
So good. And both of these novels feature these messy, desirous, self-destructive women in the midst of something like a midlife crisis, having decided that they actually want more from life than what they've become used to and maybe what they've been promised. These are characters and stories that I think a lot of our readers are really hungry for.
We love all the dysfunction. Good stuff. So that's your list.
That's my list.
All right. Bring us home, Matt.
I got one more.
All right.
It's a poetry anthology, The Wonder of Small Things, Poems of Peace and Renewal, edited by James Cruz from Story Publishers. Cruz is also was the editor of How to Love the World, Poems of Gratitude and Hope. And this is Story Publishers, of course, North Adams, the local publisher. And we've been selling, as you say, bucket loads of this book. And it's a lovely, lovely book.
Which, by the way, is a nicer way of saying bejesus.
Bejesus. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. Will you maybe edit that little fella right now? So here's the first poem in the book, if I may.
Any time you use now will be against time that you want to plug your events, but go ahead.
Okay, Wendell Berry, The Peace of Wild Things. When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free.
Beautiful.
Wendell Berry.
All right. And that is Wonder of Small Things. Okay. We have exactly one minute.
Go ahead.
I can go fast. So if I was just going to highlight one event. We have this local author talk on Sunday, August 11th at 4:30 with Lisa Amowitz and Shannon Delaney, who are fantasy and horror writers who have come up with a really cool program where they're going to talk about their writing journeys, self-publishing versus mainstream presses. I think it'll just be really interesting for local and aspiring authors.
And real quick, 20 seconds.
Two events this coming week. Sunday, July 20th, Ruth Bass, The Triangle, A Tale of Love and Death, and her daughter, Elizabeth, a novel called Happy Hour. The next day, Monday, Carol Goodman Kaufman, The First Murder, and Gerald Elias, Murder at the Royal Albert.
You both are great. Thank you very much.